So welcome to Words and Whiskey Short Pours, a monthly podcast where we have a fun time discussing fictional worlds and the people that create them, all while boozing just a little bit. My name is Cross.
And I am Josh.
And the episode that we have for you today is a great one. Our guest is best-selling author Rob Hart, author of The Warehouse, Ash McKenna series, The Paradox Hotel, the comic book series Blood Oath, Assassins Anonymous, and then, this summer release, newly released Medusa Protocol, and many, many more. Welcome again to the show, Rob. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me. As always, I'm glad that I showed up on time for this one.
You know, instead we filled it and we talked about Superman, and that was a great time.
I felt so bad because, we had previously scheduled this and I forgot to set an alert in my calendar, and I woke up and I was making pancakes for the kids and they were like, can we go see Bad Guys 2? And I'm like, yeah, we can. And then I was in a Japanese toy store with them. We were just killing time before the movie. And I was like, I wonder what's going on in the world. And I look at Instagram and I saw your message and you were like, I'm so psyched to talk in a couple of minutes. And I'm like, oh no. So I appreciate your patience.
Oh no, more than flexible, obviously. No big deal. And was Bad Guys 2 worth it? I mean, that's the real question.
It was awesome. They are surprisingly well-constructed heist movies. I mean, they're dealing with ridiculous child logic, but they're also they're pretty well written and they're fun and they're entertaining. I dig them.
I work at my day job is a pediatrics office, and I had never seen any of the Bad Guys or the first Bad Guys movie until super recently. I was just stuck in the lobby checking patients in and someone had that one and we put it on. I was not working very well. I was in it. I was sucked into the movie.
They're pretty dope. And it's also, it's kind of funny as I'm watching them, because I'm like, I'm writing the series Assassins Anonymous, which is about these reformed killers who are trying to go straight and don't want to kill anymore. And the Bad Guys books are literally about a bunch of bad guys who do heists and don't want to be bad guys anymore. And I'm like, all right, I see the theme at work here.
right. Underlying everything.
So that's a breaking news. Assassins Anonymous series, Bad Guys inspired, right?
I mean, look, I'm not going to say it didn't help a little bit. I feel like I saw the first one around the time that I was writing the first Assassins book. So I'm sure there's a little bit of shared DNA there.
Incredible.
Totally. Totally. Well, that's super exciting. I mean, there's some killer news, obviously, with Assassins since the last time that we spoke. Was it 30,000 copies of Assassins Anonymous?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. So it got picked for the Barnes & Noble, June, mystery and thriller pick. And that's, and that really sums up publishing in a lot of ways, is that, we break our asses in half, trying to sell books, and it's a game of inches. And, we do the podcasts, we do the interviews, we go to the events, we do the signings, but it's really just every now and again, the hand of God just reaches down and taps you on the shoulder. And that's all that was, and it's, we sold a ton of copies. And the timing was so perfect because it was for the month of June. Every Barnes & Noble in the country is featuring it, front table, sticker, all that fun stuff. And then the sequel came out at the end of the month. So it was it could not have been more perfect.
That's awesome. All the new people who had just picked it up they didn't even have to wait, just right there. So
yeah. Yeah, no, it was incredible. And it was funny too, because I had people coming to events and they're like, oh man, there should be another one. I'm like, I got good news for you. come back here in a week.
You know what? Yeah. Yeah, there should be. There should be.
Yeah. So before we kick it too far, I'd love to hear, we made a couple of cocktails inspired by the book, so we'd love to talk about those for just a second. But what are you drinking, Rob? What are you having this fine evening?
I am having a Four Roses bourbon.
Oh, yeah.
Because I just got in. I was meeting someone who works in TV and who just wanted to meet and have a beer. So I'm technically already two beers in.
Perfect.
So we're going to have a good time no matter what. But I didn't have time to make a proper cocktail. So I was like, straight whiskey. It'll be fine.
It's always a good substitute.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always said my favorite cocktail is whiskey in a cup for sure. Yeah. Yes.
Especially, I think that makes you the only person. Oh, no, you're not the only person on the show that's having a whiskey cocktail, I was going to say. So someone had to represent, but.
Right.
Josh, what'd you make?
So it's a little bit of Irish whiskey in honor of Baylor. So we've got that. We've got some fresh lemon juice, absinthe, and a little bit of triple sec as a sweetening agent. We got some egg white, to make it frothy and also like a pale white. And then we've got like a blood spray of Peychaud's bitters on top with a blood orange, dehydrated blood orange wheel. And I'm calling it the pale horse, I think, you know, just because it's nice and pale. It's a little bloody, but it's also a little sweet. I think it fits.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm doing something inspired by Azriel, and it's more of a, you can tell all of the lemons in it on all the photos that are going everywhere, but it is an ounce and a half of gin, a half ounce of tequila, 1 ounce of what I'd used originally was apple orchard syrup, which is like pear and apple and cinnamon. I ran out when I made the first cocktail, so this time it's Orgeau, which is not quite as good. It's still good. And then a little bit of maraschino liqueur, shaken lemons, and lemon juice, obviously.
It's that's delicious. Awesome. I forget you guys don't mess around.
Yeah, we do not. So it's exciting stuff.
Also,
so,
admittedly, yeah. Like the last time I was on this, I had my cocktail be a can of beer and a steak. So I had to like make an actual cocktail this time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see. I don't make a lot of cocktails at home, but I saw this recipe on TikTok that I want to try, which is like a cherry old fashioned, which is a cherry Coke old fashioned, which is you basically. Okay. You make a syrup out of cherries and like Mexican Coke. So you've got like the real sugar. And then it's cherry bitters, the Agnostra bitters that is in every drink over whiskey and ice. And it just looks really dope. And I want to give that a shot. But I also don't have time to make things.
That sounds so easy.
Oh, no, yeah, it's pretty basic.
Yeah.
There's like nothing wrong with just getting a cherry just Coke. Whiskey. And some whiskey and then throwing some bitters in it. And now you don't have to make a syrup. And, you know, I worked as a bartender for a number of years. And I feel like the better I got at making like overly complicated, fancy drinks, the more I just wanted like a rum and Coke. You know, like it's the thing where the chefs always like on their lunch break, they're eating like a cup of noodles in the back. Like, you don't want to, you hit a certain point where you're like, it's all food. Let me just get something in me real quick. Same thing with drinks.
All right, cool. Well, with that in mind, we'll proceed into talking about the book itself, right? So it's interesting this time to actually be out from the publication date a little bit versus, you know, ahead and whatever else. So it's been interesting too to see like thoughts and things like that reel in, obviously. But just to start off here for people who don't know, and then we'll dive into kind of some specific talking points. A summary, when Astrid, known in her assassin days as Azriel, stopped showing up to Assassins Anonymous, the group assumed her past had caught up with her. Only her sponsor, Mark, formerly the deadliest killer in the world, holds out hope that she's okay. Then during a meeting, the group gets a sign, or rather a pizza delivery. Is there another psychopath out there who actually likes olives on their pizza, or is Astrid trying to send Mark a message? Meanwhile, Astrid wakes up in a cell in a Blacksite prison on a remote island. And I don't want to say any more than that. And I think that's a good enough pitch from the summary. The summary gets a little bit further than I'd like, but I like that as sort of the scene setting.
Sure.
So where'd this idea spawn from? I know that that's the least interesting question in a lot of ways, because it's obviously more about character, but where'd this spin out of?
I mean, it was kind of two things. The first is that, you know, the first book, Assassins Anonymous, is very much about Mark, you know, and he has... just like recovery is a process, you know, like you don't hit a point where you're like, I'm okay now, everything's done. But he's still, in the first book, he kind of experiences his ego death and has his sort of like come to Jesus moment on where he needs to be and what he's doing. So I thought the biggest part of his story was kind of done. And I was like, you know, there's still room to explore things with him and growth with his character. But I also wanted to tilt the camera and look at a different character because I've got a room full of assassins. Like this is great. Like I can just like follow different characters and their pasts and their traumas and kind of dig into those. And then I think I was scrolling on TikTok one day and I found this island that off the coast of Brazil that is covered in poisonous snakes that is like, you know, people aren't allowed to go to. And I'm like, that's cool. I want to set a story there. And that was pretty much it. It was just like this cool, dumb TikTok video. And then I was like, I'm going to write a book about that.
That's fun. That's a great, great central pitch. Yeah. I do got to say, one of the things that I loved about this is that addition of the additional perspective. And then also managing to work in flashbacks without it feeling cheaty or like heavy handed, I thought was genius as far as you like actually wrapping in that as a literal plot device in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate that. And I'm so happy to hear that because when I was writing the book, to say that, like, I'm going to do POV chapters from Mark, and then I'm going to do POV chapters from Astrid, but I'm also going to have flashback chapters with Astrid, but I'm also going to write them all in first person present tense. I was fairly sure that my editor was going to try to strangle me to death when I submitted the book. So the fact that it worked, I'm still a little bit shocked that I pulled it off. Mm-hmm.
Anytime that there are like flashbacks in anything, it's nice whenever there's like a narrative handle with it as well. So like they're digging through our memories. It doesn't just feel like, oh, I need to find a way to tell people what happened. Like it's like right there within the plot of the book. And I just enjoyed that. Just the small aside. So,
I think that kind of helped make it work a little bit when I was juggling so much. But that was the fun thing about then exploring this kind of thing through a different character is like, you know, Astrid's got her own trauma. She's got her own past and background that led her to not only to this lifestyle, but to want to, you know, make amends and be a better person. So it was like, this is just fun. Like, let's figure out what this looks like now.
Yeah. And I mean, it's great. I think Josh has a pitch for another book as well. If you want to hear,
yeah,
it.
I just love her book.
Yeah.
I love Booker so much, and I want all Booker, just one full Booker book.
I'll tell you what. So the third book is already done,
uh-huh.
And the third book is called Three Hitmen and a Baby. And my editor has it. She was very, very happy with it. We're going to copy editing soon. And that's still, it's a two-hander. It's going back and forth between Mark and Astrid. There are no flashbacks. And Booker plays a big role. And he has some moments in that book that I really, really, really love.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for people to read. But I'll tell you what, like, you know, we're still trying to figure out, like, if we're going to write more books in the series. Because it's the stupid capitalism shit. It's like, you know, for are sure. enough people reading it? Are we selling enough copies? Does anything happen with the movie? Any of that stuff. But yeah, I would love to write a book that is kind of like rooted in Booker's perspective. But I will say we get to go to his apartment, and there's something about his apartment that I really, really love that I think is a cool detail. And he has a moment with Astrid like three quarters of the way through the book that I just absolutely love. So you're going to get some good Booker stuff.
I love it. I mean, you know, I probably wasn't going to read it, but now I will. So
thank God.
Get at least one. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Of course. And I mean, like, this series has been great. I can imagine that one of the more difficult things, and we kind of talked about this with Assassins, but it's interesting layering in a couple now in addition to expanding the cast of characters that are recovering. Have you found it more difficult to put these characters through more stressful or differently stressful situations and have them remain nonviolent?
Not really. I mean, it's all just like basic problem solving from a storytelling sure. perspective. It's like, you know, okay, they're in this situation. How do we think our way through this? You know, the thing that I sometimes still struggle with is just differentiating those voices, you know, because even with the third book, my editor's comments were like, you know, sometimes I forget if we're following Mark or we're following Astrid. Mm-hmm. And it's when you have these characters who are all kind of like bonded through this like shared profession, right? It's easy for them to all kind of sound very similar to each other. So it's kind of finding those differences in their voices, the differences in the reasons why they're there, just kind of like making sure they all feel very individualistic as opposed to, you know, starting to kind of drift into each other's voices.
Makes total sense. I mean, that I would imagine that's got to be very difficult, considering they're also repeating the same mantras, right? Not everyone in recovery is the same, obviously, and so that makes sense from a juggling perspective as well.
Yeah, and I think with I think I've got a nice balance with Mark and Astrid, because Mark is like, he's kind of a goofball, you know. He's like, he's very funny, he's very silly, he's very charming, you know, and he can be scary when he needs to be, but you know, he's got a very affable voice, whereas Astrid is a little bit more, you know, sarcastic and cutting and harsh. So, you know, those things are there. It's just, you know, making sure that I'm turning the dials to the correct settings.
Definitely. One of the quickest things I noticed, because I came directly from like Assassins right into Medusa, no break, you know, that like the tone of the entire novel shifts with that introduction of Astrid's point of view, just because she is not like light and quippy like Mark, you know, like it definitely takes like a heavier tone pretty much immediately, and you're like, oh, like this one's a little darker, because you have that just darker presence guiding you through the story. And I really appreciated that kind of like shift in tonality. And then it's really refreshing when you get back to Mark also, because you're like, oh, sweet, this is like back to some levity, you know?
Well, like Astrid's also really coming from a place of like really severe trauma, you know, exactly. Whereas like Mark kind of, with Mark, he got into that life because he was a little bit aimless and he found something that he was good at and just kind of got locked into the cycle of like, oh, like people are telling me I'm good at this. Like I'm getting praise, I'm getting rewards. Like this is awesome. Whereas Astrid, it's very much like everything about her is a defense mechanism. You know, it's her having been through a very difficult situation as a child and everything is in response to that. Everything is like, I need to protect myself from that. So it's, you know, yeah, like that tone is going to be way darker than her with her. And that was the funny thing too about the third book is where I was like, you know, we're dealing with some heavy themes in the second book. And I was like, okay, the third book, it's going to be a romp. It's going to be fun. Like the reader deserves this after like I kind of dragged you through the emotional ringer. And I got halfway through writing the book and I'm like, oh no, this is emotionally devastating too.
This is about to go even worse. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hard one, but I think, I don't want to say I earned it because that feels a little bit too like self-indulgent, but I think that the characters kind of earned where they end up. So okay, yeah. I hope that makes sense.
Well, I think based on what we've seen so far with the first two books, I think it's safe to say you probably earn it. The writing is incredible. And I appreciate that on the darker book, you gave us an island of venomous snakes. It just helps out. It's like, hey, we can have like a Bond villain island and this deeply serious tone just really came together in such a fun book for me. So.
And that was the cool thing, too. It's like the island really exists. It's a real place. You know, I didn't even make up a different name for it. I'm like, nah, I'm just going to use this. Because I also figured, like, you know, if you've got an island full of poisonous snakes, like, where else would you put a black site prison? Like, it's great. You get out of prison, like, you're not making it exactly. to the water.
Yeah.
You maybe gave Brazil ideas, unfortunately.
Yeah. Or Brazil's currently watching it because they're like, how the hell did he find out about our black site prison on the Snake Island?
Well, I was also thinking about like the former president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, like was a pretty like that seems like something he would have done, like stalled sure. off the rights yeah. of this island for a black site.
Yeah, absolutely. While we're on the topic of darker themes, this goes into a longer spoiler deeper spoiler for the book. So I'm just going to say, definitely you should have read it at this point. If you haven't, go read it. But just to talk about it for a moment here, and I'll leave little spoiler markers if people want to skip over this, the sort of like immediate Declan to Epstein comparison, right? And like citing and adding that into the story is a really dark direction, obviously, to go with it. Why'd you settle on that sort of mental pairing as a villain?
It was setting a challenge for myself, which was, mm-hmm. you know, I'm playing in this space of, you know, everyone is redeemable, you know, killing is not the answer, you know, this is a step too far. Can I do it with a villain that you can absolutely make the argument that they should be killed? You know, it was like, it's really, really hard to say like, you know, oh, these people who are trafficking children deserve to keep, you know, drawing air and enjoying their life. Yeah, so, yeah, it just, it felt like, can I sustain this tone with like the worst human beings imaginable?
Where's that line?
Yeah, it's interesting how like even the shift from like Stuart in the first book, before you find out it's all an act, like this is a literal compulsive serial killer, but you feel some empathy towards him and he fits in the group to some degree. And then you get this character and you're like, you know, like none of that. Like you can't even like wrap your mind around it. And it was a really, really solid way, I think. Like that final, we're still in spoiler territory, right, Cross? We don't have to hit another warning.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of final showdown with, and I do forget her name, but Madeline and Astrid, like that is emotionally devastating and so well done in the sense where you really can't like make yourself want her to live, you know?
And yeah.
I think it was such a good way to kind of wrap Astrid's moment there, still give her kind of the win of walking away, but also ultimately feeling some level of justice. So
Yeah, it's I decided to do like a bunch of weird things on this book. The other thing was that like I put like the big badass ridiculous action sequence at the beginning, like the like when,
oh,
when
the
they
church.
Go to the church.
Yeah, but we'll have to dive into the church scene for sure, because that is some of the most fun I've had reading this year.
Oh, that was such so much fun to write, but I kind of wanted like I wanted the final part of the book to be like this sort of like not even about the action, just about the emotional devastation of it.
You come in post-action, which is, I think, was a really great move there. You just kind of come into the devastation, just the emotional aftermath. So,
yeah. And I think it was something that I had to, like, because basically, like, Astrid, like, loses her sobriety for a little bit. And I had to wait for the second book to do that, really, because, you know, I'm not in recovery. Obviously, I'm not, because I'm sitting here with a giant fucking glass of whiskey.
But like, you know, Thursdays are different, you know.
Yeah, but I have friends who are, and when I was talking to them about this initial idea, they were like, you know, look, you know, this could be cool, but you got to treat this with respect because this saved my life. It saved other people's lives. Like, you can't treat it like a goofy hook or something. And I respect that, you know. And the reality is that people do slip and people do fall off the wagon and people do get back to it. So that's why in the first book I was like, we're really going to stick to this. Like, we're not going to, it's not going to be, but my favorite example of this is Death Wish, the mm-hmm. movie with Charles Bronson. That was actually based on a novel by Brian Garfield, which is actually a phenomenal book. And it's a book that's about anti-violence and anti-vigilantism. Like, the entire point of the book is that it was wrong. And mm-hmm. then they made the Charlie Bronson movie where he's just like, you know, blowing everyone away.
Of course.
Yeah.
And Garfield hated it. He actually wrote a sequel called Death Sentences as sort of like an apology for how badly he thought they fucked up the movie. So I was like, I can't treat it like window dressing. In the first book, they got to stick to it. But, you know, with the second book, I think I had a little bit more leeway to kind of like veer off course.
Oh, definitely. And I feel like, also, I mean, with Astrid losing her sobriety there, it's done with a lot of like depth and respect too. That is one thing that I noticed throughout both of these, is that like on paper, it's AA for assassins sounds goofy, but it is actually like handled so incredibly respectfully, in my opinion. And you know, my father is someone who's been like 30 years in recovery, and you know, you see a lot of similar themes across different people who have gone through it. And I think it just like, I was very curious, like before coming in here to talk to you, I'm like, hey, have you like gone through experience in recovery? Because it feels so well done, I guess. So I just have to say, as someone who's been like tangentially to the side of it as well, it's, I'm impressed by it. I was really impressed with like how it's handled, the seriousness it's given, while still being like a really fun concept. So.
Thank you. I've got friends who are in recovery. I've attended open meetings with them so that I can kind of like, you know, get the feel for it. So yeah, I went into it with the utmost of respect. And it's a fine line to walk, because like, yeah, it's a goofy concept, but it's also like, you know, it's, I'll tell you this, one of the best pieces of fan mail I ever got in my life. It was shortly after Assassins came out, and this woman wrote to me and she's like, hey, I found your book at the library and I read it and I went out and bought a copy. And, you know, I tried recovery at one point. It didn't really work for me, but I'm going to give it another shot now after reading your book. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, yeah. if my career ends at this moment, like, I can hang my hat on this and I'll be happy.
Seriously.
You know, and it's, you know, the fact that the fact that my original friends who I spoke to when I started this are still friends with me, I feel right. like is also a good sign.
Definitely.
Yeah, you've kept the right crowd in mind, and they've remained, at, you know, faithful as such. Yeah, it's really interesting too, especially just like thinking more about the book too. Astrid is obviously in like a similar state to Mark throughout most of this, and faces like the sort of mental struggles, and she goes through, again, sort of the same thing that Mark goes through in the, like, the goal is for us to not be gods, right? Like, we need to maintain this. And then we cut to that hard break, like we were talking about, from breaking sobriety, which immediately reminded me of Paradox Hotel, by the way, in the sort of missing scene there, which was excellent in kind of a meta context, which was an excellent choice, but also one where I kind of wish that we would have just seen more in her, like, what was she mentally going through leading up until that moment in which she decides actually to follow through and kill these people first before Madeline, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's an interesting balance, especially to strike as someone in recovery, right? With the most viable person you can imagine.
You know, it's interesting because I absolutely see your point. I definitely thought about it of like showing more of that. But I think what the side I eventually came down on was that, like, it's like that old Hitchcockian thing. It's like, you know, the monster you don't see is so much scarier right. than the monster you see. So like watching Astrid kind of processing this stuff, you know, would be one thing. Like walking into this mansion and it's just like littered with, like, you know, massacred bodies is just like, oh shit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that, for the record. I'm just thinking like on the boat or something beforehand, but I guess you kind of also get it in the post in some way after she kills Declan and actually gets the information and realizes what's going on, right? And kind of like comes to terms with it. It's interesting to me too that Declan kind of just surrenders because he understands that he is a bad dude and that this has been coming the whole time as well, which feels like a fascinating decision on his part as a character. Yeah,
I mean, I don't know. I'll tell you, okay, luckily this is not on a podcast that's going to be broadcast out to public. So we're talking in generalities right now, but a friend of a friend, allegedly, and not in any actual reality, and none of this is real.
Capacity, yep.
Yeah, you know, may kill people professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, this friend of a friend, I remember hearing this very interesting story allegedly about how he allegedly specializes in killing sex offenders and pedophiles and has said that a few times that when, like, in their final moments, they seem to be thankful. And so I thought that was like a really, really interesting space to play in of like, you know, do they actually know what they're doing is so terrible and that it's so compulsive that they kind of get to a point where they can't help themselves. And when someone finally relieves them of that, there's like a certain part of them that is like, thank God.
Yeah. That just like turns off and they're like, okay, I've released now.
Yeah.
You know, too much of a coward in many ways to do it themselves. But I mean, that's a lot on a public facing podcast. I would only say something like that on a private podcast,
right?
But
for sure,
yeah, of course. And none of this is real. Allegedly. Or actually happened. I made it all up,
right? Absolutely,
for sure. Nobody, if this was on a public facing podcast, is going to hear that and go, I think Rob Hart funds his books by killing sex offenders for money.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. That. No, for sure.
Oh, man, there's a lot about this book to love too. Just to, we'll segue away from the Epstein angle here and move into one of the things that I love the most was one of the cutaways that happened deep in the novel in which we see 6 months prior, right? I think it's part eight because I thought it also coordinated with step eight, right? I couldn't tell if that was intentional or if that was your plan as a part of the breakdown of the novel. But
oh, I have no plan.
Okay, well, it works out perfectly with, you know, the AA step of like part eight and the list, right? Because they're sitting down, they're talking about the list at the same time, and that being sort of the next step for them. So Mark says, you know, that's the thing about revenge. Nothing changes when you get it. During that critical conversation in New York, portraying sobriety, the choice to break sobriety and acid's part, I think is so well done. And I love that as like the backbone before. I know I was like, maybe we see the boat, but this is like the leverage of what she's giving up, right? Like this is what she's walking away from.
Yeah, you know, I look, like I love a good revenge movie. I love the John Wick movies. I love the, you know, killer gets pulled out of retirement and slaughters 100 people movies. But I think in reality, you know, those things are probably pretty empty. You know, I mean, it doesn't change anything. It doesn't bring anyone back. It doesn't. It's just, you know, we never really sit with these characters after they've done all this. And they're like, well, how do you feel now? Like, they might feel good in the moment, but how do they feel like, you know, a week later or a month later or 6 months later? You know, what's changed? And I would like to think that people are a little bit more complicated than, you know, I'm just going to kill that person and feel better about it.
Yeah. It's not a release valve in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not if you're sane. I mean, obviously that would be something that like Stuart would fall back into.
Oh yeah.
Not same. A little bit of a line to draw, but right. I watched it fade. I watched it flicker.
So I have like the last sip of my cocktail and then I have a White Claw and I looked at both of them and I couldn't make a decision. And whenever I looked back up, my question was gone. Yeah, so, you know, I'll let you take the next one, Chris.
fair enough. Yeah. There are a number of great additional characters that are added over the course of the story. I particularly liked sort of everyone that we met along Mark's journey. I love sticking to the decision of Mark giving up his ear. Can you talk more about like the follow through and the thought process there of like, because it does feel like it does break the principles, kind of like is argued a couple of times.
No, it does. It does. And we revisit that a little bit in the third book and explore it a little bit more in depth. But yeah, it's just like, it felt like a little bit of a cop-out if he didn't give up his ear at the end of it, you know?
It feels like there's an expectation that at some point he's going to let him off the hook.
You know? See, yeah, exactly. There's that expectation of like, it's okay, buddy. We're good now. And it's like, no, I kind of wanted him to pay that price, you know? Because you're dealing with characters that are, you know, and you know, obviously I'm not writing from a place of experience, but they're all professional killers. They're all well versed in things like pain and violence. So they just speak it a little bit differently. And so, you know, taking someone's ear is probably like a little bit like if I were to say to one of you, like, you know, hey, you got to cut off your ear or I'm not going to do this podcast, you know, you're going to say no. And then I'm not going to be on the podcast.
Sorry, Rob.
Yeah. But
like audio equipment. So if you're like, hey, you got to send me a microphone and I'll do this podcast, we'd be like, okay. But somebody else might be like, I don't have a microphone to send you. You know,
so. Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted to go against that expectation because I figured like people are going to think like, oh, everything's going to be cool by the end. And I'm like, nah, that would be too easy.
Yeah. It would be so against Levine's character as well, which is one of the things. I mean, both Levine and Quarashi are such great introductions to the story. And Levine's fascinating. I hope he comes back in that third book, even if it's just for a second. But
oh, I love Levine. I also there's a line. So, I think it's
is it a spoiler if I give you like a little tiny taste of what's going to happen in the third book?
No. You already did a little bit. Yeah.
So in the third book, Levine is actually Mark's sponsor.
Hell yeah!
That's so good.
That makes so much sense. That makes so much sense. I love that. Love it.
I didn't even think of that when I was starting to write the book, but I think I got to this point where I'm like, I need Mark to have like a moment with someone here. And I'm like, but he doesn't really have a sponsor. I'm like, oh shit, he can have a sponsor. It could be Levine.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Incredible.
We're senior in it. Yeah.
Which is also great wrapping back from like, you know, X amount of time earlier when Levine was willing to just drop sobriety. Then and there, if he found out that the pale horse was in front of him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the fun thing about writing the series. It's like, and look, like writing a series is hard because it gets to a point where you feel like you're inviting people to a Tupperware party. You know, it's like you're just doing your best to keep it interesting and keep people coming. But also, like, being able to play with these characters and like bring them back and show different facets of them and different sides of them. And then it's like, okay, cool. I'm going to stick them in this situation now and let's see what they do differently. It's so much fun.
Well, I'll tell you, I legitimately want a lot more Tupperware. So
thank God.
I have so many storage needs.
Yeah, I was actually earlier today, I was writing a little bit of an essay about this because it can be really easy to fall back in, especially sequelizing or like I was talking specifically about the book series that we're covering right now, which is the First Law, the final sequels, which step out and it's like the kids are inheriting like sort of the thing. But Abercrombie sidesteps a lot of that by like putting all the nostalgia there, but then killing it off pretty quickly, saying like, no, I'm going to break your toys just like I did before. It's no different. And I feel like that's what I also really like about this is not only do you have the lenses that have shifted with the second story, right? So you get to add that perspective. But in addition, it's still the same sort of anxieties and fears. You're still playing in the same garden. You're just growing different plants.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fun for me as a writer because it's like, look, like the easiest thing to do in a book is just like if someone's being a nuisance, you just kill them, you know. Yeah. And it's like to then have to like think around that, but then also deal with the consequences of what happens when, you know, you leave someone dangerous alive. It's like it's just unlimited storytelling potential.
It's good. Unfortunately, I love it. Not unfortunately, it's great.
So I have a question wrapping back to the Tupperware party statement, because, you know, to me, you're like a Tupperware party, you're selling something for sure.
Yeah.
And I'm curious. Oh, sorry. Special delivery for my wife. One of my first thoughts reading the series was like, this feels, in a very complimentary way, so tailor-made for an adaptation. How much are you considering that while you're writing this? Like, does it cross your mind like, oh, this would look great in a movie or a TV show? Or is it just, it just happens to come across that way, you know?
I don't really think in terms like that when I'm doing the actual writing. I think that I just generally, I like writing action, you know, in part. Like, I do fight training. I trained in Krav Maga for years. I train in Muay Thai now. So I think I'm just kind of like, my brain is just kind of like built around that idea of like how bodies kind of like move into space and then how to make an action scene like interesting and compelling. So yeah, I've never really thought like, oh, this would look really cool on a screen.
Okay. Yep.
But I do, you know, I have like, I mean, the Assassin's books got optioned by Steven Spielberg and Amblin, which was ridiculous. And they're currently developing it. They brought on a director who is amazing and would be so awesome if this works out. And who knows, because the Hollywood stuff very rarely does. But yeah, I feel like I am ultimately writing in that kind of like that wheelhouse of like, this would probably look good on a screen.
Right.
But the only thing that I wrote very specifically in these books that I would love to see in a movie is for Kenji to be played by Hiroyuki Sanada. Like, that is the one thing that I would just kill for. Yeah. Is because Kenji is like one of my favorite characters. Hiroyuki Sanada is one of my favorite actors. And that's the one time I was like, if this worked out, this would be great.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I love that as a comparison point. And like, yeah, we obviously talked about the Amblin adaptation, I think, between both Paradox Hotel and this last time that we spoke. But I'm really, really interested to see this make it in that direction, especially now with the sequel. I feel like it just lends itself so naturally to fitting in also with the current action movie environment in a big way. Obviously, like, nobody's getting sequelized in a way. Like you said, the retired. But this takes a completely different angle on it.
I think it super benefits actually from this moment that like has already happened is happening, because it is kind of like a deconstruction of that in a way that isn't just more of the same, you know? So
it's not John Wick.
What I'm hoping. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, like, it would
be sad for John Wick 8 too, but you know,
oh yeah. I mean, I'm hopeful, you know, especially because they're going to give me a gigantic check if they actually make the movie, and naturally, you know, that's never a bad thing. But yeah, no, it would be. So have you guys read Jordan Harper?
No,
I have not.
Okay. No. So Jordan's an amazing, amazing writer. And so his book, She Rides Shotgun, just came out as a movie. And
okay.
Like, even seeing my friend's book turned into a movie was just such a cool and surreal experience. Like, sitting there in the theater, like, a whole bunch of us like made it a day. Like, we all went out and like we went to go see it, and you know, and it was interesting because they made changes and they shifted some things around, and then the book was obviously better because the book's always better. But just like sitting there and watching my buddy's book get turned into a movie was just like the coolest thing. And I'm like, man, yeah. I would not be upset about that.
Yeah, I feel like it's hard too, because like, you don't want to be like, oh, like, a book is successful if it's adapted. Like, the art and the medium, it's already like perfect, you know, but like, it feels so cool to just like get that recognition of like, oh, people wanted to make a movie out of this, and now it's at this like other echelon, and like, now there's like a whole new spin in life to it. It seems like it'd be so exciting and also frustrating, but you know?
yeah I mean, look, and the recognition is cool, but like, looking at it from a purely like analytical and like dollars and cents perspective, it's like, look, I'm a full-time writer. I want to be a full-time writer for the rest of my life. I also want to, you know, send my daughter to a nice college. I want to, you know, be able to pay my bills, but put money away for my retirement, you know, all of these things. And the reality is that if a movie gets made, that movie, even if it's not a good movie, you're going to sell a shitload of books, because it's basically like it's an ongoing advertisement for your book.
the and worst even thing if it's a bad happen. Movie, people will want to be like, oh, well, you got to read the book. That was good. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. The worst thing that happens is that you're just one of those authors where people say the book was better. And so, like, not to be too cutthroat about it, but it's like, you know, that changes your career trajectory in such a big way. And it brings a degree. And look, like, money does not buy happiness, but it does buy comfort. And comfort can be a form of happiness, you know? And so it provides an added layer of security for a job that feels very insecure. You know, I'm like, this year is a good year for me. Like, I'm doing pretty good. I feel comfortable. Last year was kind of a tough year, you know, because it's like, it comes in waves. When you're a full-time writer, it's like, I might get a check in January and not get another check until like June. And right. you can make it work and you could stretch them out. But it's still, it's like kind of scary and kind of hard sometimes. So, you know, yeah, I'll take whatever money they're going to throw at me, because that just means, again, that I can continue to do this in a way that like makes me happy. But I can also, you know, buy Labubus for my daughter. And so she continues to love me.
As someone who has spent his life in a constant state of survivably broke, you know, I actually like super appreciate just like, hey, at the end of the day, I would love a movie check, because like,
yeah,
that makes it so you can also like take more risks in writing, you know, like, exactly. Oh, hey, let me stretch my creative legs. And if it doesn't work out, I'm not like pissing myself about, oh, well, that's like 6 months down the drain or something, you know, like, so I just think like, It would be real nice to see that movie happen, you know? Wink, wink. If anybody out there who can do that is listening, the fans want it, because I'm a fan and I want it. So,
well, my understanding is that the script is going to be done soon, and then we'll see what happens next. They've got a financer. They've got a director. I don't know. We will see.
Very cool. Very cool.
Not that we're becoming news heavy or anything like that, but anything on the Paradox or Warehouse side of things either?
So
Amazon by Warehouse yet? Just kidding.
Paradox is dead. That came close. There was a really cool actress on board for that, and just no one bought it. But that was also, so after the Hollywood strikes, budgets got kind of cut everywhere, and no one wanted to do sci-fi. It would have been too expensive. Warehouse, so the Warehouse and the Ash McKenna books were kind of in a weird place, because they were both optioned by Village Roadshow, which just went bankrupt. But it looks like Warehouse is going to move over to another company, which we haven't signed the paperwork, so I don't know if I can say it yet, but that's cool. And they've just detangled the stuff with Ash, so they want to start pitching that soon. So like,
oh, cool.
Stuff is moving, but it's also like, it's Hollywood moving, which means like my agents have been telling me for like 3 weeks, they're like, the Warehouse paperwork is going to show up any day. And my inbox is still empty of Warehouse paperwork. So it's just, again, like Hollywood is just like, so before we did this podcast, I met with a TV guy who, you know, he's a fan of my books, but he also might be pitching on something that I'm working on. And we went out to have a beer, and I was talking about like how it just feels like the longest, most drawn out process ever. He's like, whatever you think it is, it's worse.
Yeah, I feel like it's like the ultimate version of having your landlord send a plumber. You're like, all right, it could be like today or tomorrow, between 8 and 8, or next year.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
And I might pay for it, or you might, and also we might just evict you. So,
yeah. Yep. Like, well, yeah, it's like it's in publishing, everything is no until one day it's yes. Whereas in Hollywood, everything is yes until one day it's no.
That is a great way of putting it. Yeah, that's frustrating. But, you know, hey, it is what it is.
No, I mean, I'm here. I could be mining coal. You know, I could be sitting in a box wearing a suit, like making some asshole rich. And I'm not. I'm trying to make myself rich and then failing spectacularly. But it's coming along.
Hey, failing mediumly, because you got deals in the works. You know?
Irons in the fire, as always. Yeah, no, I'm with you there, and I'm glad and excited to see this happen. It's also been great to be along this ride kind of simultaneously with you from like 2022 to now, and like see all this change and develop, and see like the articles and everything else that you're writing. And I feel like I've physically watched that bloom, which is awesome. So,
yeah, you know, and I'm so thankful for it, you know, because it's just, it's so nice that there are certain like podcasts or publications where like, we're at a point now where we're just buddies and we're just shooting the shit and we're having a good time, you know? And it's, you know, there are people who kind of like come in and out of this whole process. Like they feel like they might get something out of it or they don't pay attention to you until you're, you know, slightly more popular or powerful. But I feel good to be in a place where it's like, I know who my friends are. I know the people who've stuck with me. And that's just, it's a nice feeling.
Yeah, definitely. I for sure get that. And it's fascinating because this all started from, I took your class in like 2021, 2020 originally, which is where I fell into this whole thing as we were beginning our show. And so it's been a lot of fun. So
yeah, that was a fun one.
I still have all the notes anyway.
Nice. Good. I'm working on and when I say working on, it's on a back burner right now, but I'm working on like a craft of writing book because I love the teaching stuff. I love you know, I'm teaching in an MFA program and I'm doing stuff for Writer's Digest and it's so much fun. And it's helpful for me, you know, because beyond like working with other writers, which is just super fun and is important because when most of your job is spent like sitting around in like basketball shorts by yourself, like eating Cheetos and drinking Diet Coke, like you need to remember that you're not alone, that there are other people who are doing this too and dealing with the same shit that you are. But it's also really helpful for me just to explain things, to say like, this is why I do this, this is why I do this. Because then I understand it better. You know, it's like so much of what I do is just sort of like instinctual. It's just like, well, that's just what I do. You know, it's like the way I make coffee in the morning. It's the way I cook eggs, whatever. That's just what I do. But when I'm actually explaining to someone, these are the reasons that I do it like this. It's like, oh, cool. I kind of understand my craft a little bit better now.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just reinforces that. It reinforces the neural pathways, right? You also kind of lifetime sometimes are disentangling ideas. You're like, well, I don't entirely believe the thing that I like set in the bullet point here that I thought was my talking point. Instead, it's kind of like this, you know, I find that at the very least talking about things and like writing it to talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. As you interrogate it. Speaking of writing things, what's obviously, you know, we've got three Hitmen and a Baby, which is the next book. What else is sort of on the docket or projects?
I've got a book coming out in January and it's called Detour, and I'm co-writing it with Jeff Rake, who is the showrunner and creator of the TV show Manifest. And that has been super fun. Jeff is an awesome guy. I love working with him. He's a TV guy, so he like understands how to collaborate.
I was going to say, I mean, like, I don't know if you have or haven't co-written in the past, but like, how different is that process? How does that...
I've co-written a bunch, especially with Alex Segura, who is a good buddy. Like, we wrote a novel together, we wrote a comic book together, you know, and it's different with everyone. With Alex, since he's chiefly like a novel and comics guy, it was a lot of like back and forth. With Jeff, it's like a lot of like world building. And so the book is called Detour, and it's like a sort of like a mystery box kind of thing, sort of like in the vein of Lost. And so that's awesome. January 13th. I'm working on the second book now, and there should be a third book in the series. And then, yeah, I'm also, and in between, in the little free moments that I have, I'm working on a YA fantasy book for my daughter.
That's awesome. I was going to ask, is there any like genres that you haven't had the opportunity to explore that you would be interested in the future? And what would be like your top one?
Yeah, YA and fantasy are up there right now.
I had the question ready and I felt like you answered it. You know?
Yeah. No, this is challenging, man. It's like, it's super fun. Like, it's a fantasy book and I'm rooting a lot of it in like Irish and Celtic mythology because I just, you know, I'm Irish. I thought it would be fun to write about Irish stuff. And it's just like, it's not hard to like, I mean, obviously like a lot of the stuff I've written has been very adult and very violent, and like, you know, a lot of bad words and stuff like that. And it's not really hard removing like the language. It's not hard kind of like toning down the language for a younger audience. It's just, it's a lot of like really crazy world building. Like fantasy is like the expectations are so much higher, but also writing from, I think, a more, you know, innocent and hopeful perspective than sort of like an older and jaded perspective is really interesting. So it's been fun. I got like 20,000 words on it so far. And I think it's, you know, I think it's a cool idea, and I've talked about it with my daughter, and she thinks it's really awesome, and you know, hopefully she still likes it if it gets published. Right. Like, it's going to come out when she's like 13, and then like by the time she's 13, she's not going to want anything to do with me. So we shall see.
Well, when I was 13, I was devouring YA fantasy novels. So, you know,
I'm hoping yeah. I'm excited for her to finally
just put that one out under like a pen name and then don't tell her it's you. You know?
I mean, I see, that's the thing though. It's like, I'm too much of a narcissist. Like, it has to be under my name. like people have been saying, like, do you want to write under a pen name? I'm like, no, I want everyone to know that I wrote this.
I feel like the only way, like this, what's the Stephen King pen name?
Richard Bachman.
Yeah, I feel like that's the most narcissistic way to do it. Where you're like, can I be a bestseller twice?
Can I do this again?
Yeah.
Fair point. What's the research process different? Like, what's the differences in the research process there for like going for you for going fantasy versus, you know, obviously the more conventional world building that exists around us? What's that been like?
An utter and complete nightmare. So
you can't just like walk around your fantasy world and be like, oh, that's cool.
well, okay. So I'll give you guys like a little bit about, so sure. It's like, you know how you open a fantasy book and there's the first thing you see is a map, right? And so this is a book about a father and his daughter, and they're the ones who go around and make the maps. Which I love as a concept. And so you've got this, and they're on a boat, and it's in like a sort of like, you know, there's like a main city, and it's again, like we're dealing with a lot of Irish mythology, but there's a lot of islands, and they go out, they map the islands. And obviously like it turns into a story about like colonialism and shit. But so I've got to learn about ancient map making techniques, because it's like, I mean, I don't even know the time period you would set it in, because again, it's fantasy. It's all made up. I can do whatever I want. But I would say I've been using like pirate level technology. So I've got to figure out sailing, map making, like all these things that like, I don't need to be 100% technically precise, but I do need to be believable. And so just trying to figure out, like, I don't need to know how we make maps today. I need to know how we made maps like 400 or 500 years ago.
Yeah.
And there are some pretty good resources, but as you start drilling down further and further and further into specifics, the kind of things you need to really make a book feel like alive, it's like, God damn it, man. Like there was one day. So my partner, she's a brilliant tarot reader, and she does a live show every day on TikTok, doing like tarot stuff. And she went upstairs to go do her show, and I'm sitting on the couch watching YouTube videos like on just pirate stuff. And I would have to watch like a 20-minute video just to get like the one little piece of information I needed. She went up, she did her show. 5 hours later, she came back down, and I was still sitting here watching pirate videos on YouTube. Just literally an entire day of just like, and I got some good information, but it was also like, it's a slog. You know, but it's also, it's a fun challenge. So I figure, you know, why not give it a shot?
That's fun. Awesome. I actually, Cross, you're more well-read than I am.
Okay.
In like the fantasy genre, especially. Well, I mean, that's probably the genre I've read the most. I cannot think of a cartography central fantasy series or novel.
Yeah, no, the only one that I can
and
think
that's
of,
such a is, good idea. Like it's giving me pause, because I'm like, how does that not like a central plot in more fantasy novels, you know?
Yeah, it's not at all. The only one that gets even close in my mind, and it's not at all in that way, is Sea of Trolls. Was this, I think it was Nancy Farmer. I read it when I was 13, and I still have that in my brain somewhere. And that was Norse, and they were Vikings, obviously, and it didn't tackle a lot of that. But there was a little bit of like exploratory, obviously, but not map making specifically. It's a great angle.
When I played Age of Empires, I would put a lot of money into cartography, because that map making was important. And I'm like, how did nobody else go cartography? That's actually so sick. As soon as you said it, like light bulbs went off in my head. I was like, they make the maps. That's so cool. You know,
It's so much fun. I'm super, super excited for this. And I'm going to see, I want to try to have it done sort of like by the end of the year or early next year. And then I told my agent, and I'm like, then it's your problem. You figure it out. Like, I got nothing there.
Incredible.
Fair. Josh, did you have any other questions on Medusa?
You know, I have like a comment, but it's kind of in a vacuum now. But like just one thing that I thought was really fun and interesting. Yeah, of course. Was the I want to talk about the church scene a little bit.
Mm. Okay.
Because one, it's great action, but two, it introduces somewhat of a concept where there's this like unspoken agreement amongst them that like protecting the baby is a worth it. Like the baby's more important than sobriety.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know why, like that moment stuck with me so hard where like him and Booker like agree without saying anything. They're like, hey, or I think it says we've already discussed it or something like that. But there's like this like, hey, me and Booker, we're going to maintain our sobriety until we can't, but baby's getting away. And that was like such a cool human moment. And also like the worst little like action movie head parts of me were like, oh, I want to see a moment later where they all just like break. But you know, yeah, I don't like I care about these characters and emotionally I don't want them to break. But like that moment in the church where they're like, hey, if we got a break to make sure that this happens, like that's fine with me. And I thought that that was such an interesting thing because every other moment in it, it's framed in like a, no, like you can't, you, it's once you start breaking, you keep breaking. And in that one moment, everyone's like, yeah, no, that's worth it. That's good. That's good.
Well, you will be happy to know that the entire third book is about them protecting the baby.
Right. Which as soon as you said the name of the book, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. So sick.
Well, so this is something that you get into when you're training in Krav Maga. So Krav is an Israeli martial art that is, right, you know, very famously brutal and, you know, predicated on, you know, real world application. You know, it's not about, you know, sparring in a ring. It's about like surviving a street fight. And so you spend a lot of time like drilling, you know, defending against multiple attackers against knives, against guns, you know, and it's a lot of really, really, really intense training. But there's also a lot of like sitting around and talking. And one of the things you talk about is like you have to decide what you're willing to die for, what you're willing to go to jail for, what you're willing to kill someone else for, you know, and because it's a big question, and it's a question I never want to have to answer. You know, like I don't fight train because I want to fight people. I don't ever want to fight anyone outside of a controlled like classroom setting.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
But you know, if I have to sit there and think about that, I would never fight for my own ego because ego is stupid. But oh man, like you threaten my daughter, you know, I'm going to crack you in half like a wishbone.
Of course.
You know, it's not even a question. And then it's a matter of like, you know, finding those spaces in between of like, you know, what am I willing to do these things for? And I just think that's such a fascinating question. And I kind of wanted them to have this moment of like, you know, everything matters up until this point. That's the breaking point. That's where this is a hard line. It's a hard limit. We will do whatever it takes. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's funny. I was trying to play with this idea of, you know, we think of like the assassin character as kind of like a noble character, you know, like there's a certain degree of nobility to what they're doing, but really they're just killing a whole lot of people. Like there's not a whole lot of nobility to it, but I still wanted these characters to be noble, you know, like because that is a place that they have gotten to. Like it's an achievement they've made in their lives of like, We're not necessarily good people at this point, but we're making better decisions.
Definitely. Which so pulls me to my one other thing I wanted to mention. Again, not really a question. I love that there is a more specific like substance that they're addicted to. It's the God energy, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's something so tangible about that and it makes so much sense. And it's like understandable from someone who doesn't kill people for a living and doesn't experience the God energy. You still get it, you know? Like, and I think that that's a really cool thing. That's just a little bit of an aside, but that was like the one other thing that I kind of wanted to mention while we were here and talk about, because I just think it's such a cool concept and such a well, like simply stated term. Like you hear that God energy and you're like, oh, I get it. Like I would get addicted to that.
So, well, I know what that means. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing that's, you know, and obviously like it doesn't need to be a substance to be addictive. Like anything could be addictive.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. two small wrap-up questions. One, Superman feelings.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's the happiest I've been in ages.
That's what we said.
Yeah, look, man, I grew up on Superman, and so and I just couldn't cotton to Zack Snyder's take on the character. You know, like those were not for me. Superman is a goofball, and but also just like an unflinchingly good and kind person. And I sat like that entire movie. I just had the stupidest smile on my face. I was so happy, and I got to see it again last week. I took my daughter, and you know, it's always kind of dicey with her because she's a 10-year-old girl. She wants to watch 10-year-old girl stuff. And then she was not necessarily interested in seeing a Superman movie. And then after the movie was over, she leaned over to me. She's like, that was really good. And I was like, awesome.
Yeah. That's a huge success. You know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That was really good from a 10-year-old girl. Like that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, having a cute and rambunctious dog certainly helped.
Right,
but that's the thing that like James Gunn is so good at that is that he understands that comic books were a medium for children, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and it's like as you age these stories up and try to make them like adult and dark and gritty, they lose that thing that made them special, and that's why the Snyder movies didn't really work. It's like you forgot these are stories for children. You know, you can tell these stories in a way that appeals to adults, but if you lose that thing that made it interesting and special in the first place, like, what's the point?
Exactly. I was going to say, like, on top of that, it's for children, but like, there's also, I think if the wrong person heard that, they would make a worse movie because A, it's for kids. Whereas like James Gunn really approaches it in like, just because it should appeal to children and the medium it's from is for children doesn't mean it shouldn't like impact us deeply, because at the end of the day, like our inner child and humanity is within children and us. And like, you know, I think it hits such a good balance. It's one of the things me and Cross talked about the other day. Well, whenever we were just doing a full yeah. episode on Superman,
when yeah. I messed up and didn't when, show up.
I wasn't going to say why we did a whole episode on Superman. Yep. It's because sometimes authors have too much going on in their brains.
The bad guys.
To consider the real world. Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I love how Gunn approaches in Superman, like that childlike wonder, that very joyful, very hopeful, like tone that permeates throughout while still like not lessening it. It doesn't demean itself in any sort of way because, hey, it's for kids. It's like, it's just as much of a gut punch when it is. It's just yeah. as hopeful. It's just as effective. It doesn't, being for kids doesn't lessen it, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's the thing. It's like, just because this was a medium that was originally aimed at children doesn't mean it needs to be childish.
Yes.
Right. You know?
Which, hey,
yeah.
gets me bad excited guys for too. Your YA fantasy novel.
You know? Also, yeah. so.
Also bad guys too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Final question. Something you'd recommend to people that you've either watched, read, listened to, enjoyed recently that's been consuming you or your life?
Oh, man. I would definitely say that everyone should go see She Rides Shotgun. Right, and then down. After seeing the movie, pick up the book and see how much better the book is. But
that was by absolutely. Jordan Harper, right?
Yeah. And the movie is still fantastic. Like it was just really, really, really well done. And I mean, we walked out very, very happy with what we saw. And Jordan seems pretty happy with it too. But yeah, the book is just phenomenal.
Perfect. All right. Well, sounds good. Well, thank you so much, Rob. Where can people find you, interact with you on the internet? Where are you these days?
You can find me on my website, robwhart.com, from which you can find my Substack, my Instagram, my Blue Sky. I got off of Twitter because that's just sort of turned into like a weird Hello. Nazi hangout.
Yeah. It's mostly just there to feel bad, you know?
Yeah. Even worse these days. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. This was fantastic.
Cheers.